better.
Morning and welcome back to Shattering Myths. Our number, if you wish to engage in the conversation, is 877-376-45. During the break, Scott and I were busy talking about how religions go about deceiving people. And I thought that we would kind of play along those lines here a little bit this morning, because it does tie in a bit to the Romney story. You know, one of the concerns I think that people have is that there's enough people that know that Mormonism is a really silly religion, that there is zero possibility that Mormonism is true. And would you want someone who is a devoted Mormon to have control over the most powerful military on earth? If you aren't smart enough to recognize that Mormonism is a con, that it is a lie, do you really want that guy to be able to push a button and nuke the world? I think not. Now, when I say that, let's talk a moment about Mormonism. The whole idea was that in the 1800s, the 19th century, Joseph Smith allegedly stumbled upon a tablet, and that his great gift was the ability to translate. Languages, alphabets that were previously unknown. So he attempts to translate this to a person who wrote down his translation. Then the person lost what he had written, and he says, "Hey, you need to do that again." And then he comes up with this whole long story about, "Oh boy, I don't have the tablets anymore, but let me see if I can get a tablet again." He comes up with another story. To test his great ability as a decipherer of languages. Shortly thereafter, there were artifacts in the United States and museums from ancient Egypt before we had the Rosetta Stone and before people knew how to translate the hieroglyphics. He was given this and said, "Oh yeah, I know exactly what this is. This is a meeting between Pharaoh and Abraham, and here's the discussion that took place." Well, that actual relic from Egypt describes a voyage to the underworld, and the pharaoh's answers to questions that are being asked as it relates to how they pass through the underworld. He got it completely wrong. Of course, the big claim in Mormonism has been proven by science to be totally and completely false. What the Mormons claim, what Joseph Smith claimed, is that Yehudim, who we call Jews today, back about 3,000 years ago, decided, okay, well, God may have given this homeland to us, but we want out of here. And so they built this giant sailing ship, and they sailed from Israel across the Mediterranean through the Straits of Gibraltar and on to America, where it was a land that had absolutely no indigenous people, and the Jews became the Indians. For example, I'm Sioux Indian. The Indians in the Americas, the Incas, the Aztecs, the Mayans, and all of the Indian tribes of North America and Central America and South America were really Jews. Well, of course, now with DNA, we the heritage of the peoples who occupy the Americas, and guess what? They came across the land bridge of the Bering Sea, across the Aleutian Islands. The DNA is Chinese, Siberian, Mongolian. It is not Jewish, not one ounce of Jewish DNA. Joseph Smith lied. He made it up to enrich himself. It is a complete crock. And somebody who isn't smart enough to say, you know, I'm going to do a little investigation to see if the religion that I am living and that I am raising my children is true, and someone not willing to do that, I don't want them in the Oval Office of the United States. But you look at really every religion, of the popular religions, most all of them were conceived the same way. You look at Paul. Paul didn't create his religion of Christianity out of, of total whole new cloth. No, what he did is he tried to usurp the credibility of Yahweh and his Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and said that his religion was confirming and was revitalizing the story that is in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, when in fact what Paul said is the opposite of what is recorded in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. He misquotes Yahweh, takes what he said out of context, and then twists it to weave himself into the story. The same thing was true with Muhammad in the creation of Islam. Much of what is the basis of the Quran is a twisted and plagiarized, misquoted version of the Jewish Talmud, which is based upon arguments that rabbis had regarding the Torah. He then takes those stories, takes them out of context, misquotes them to weave himself into the story. Rabbi Akiva and his creation of Pharisaic Judaism, the only surviving form of the religion today, created these arguments where he used, we'll call them mind tricks, to say that since God created free will, therefore we should be able to vote on the interpretation of who has power. So if there are a dozen rabbis in the room, and we invite Yahweh to attend our meeting, and the rabbis vote in favor of giving us power, and God votes, well, we outnumber him, so based upon free will, it's us who are empowered. And it's exactly the same thing. Let's take something that God said so that we have some credibility. Let's misquote it, let's twist it, and based upon that, we will create a religion that will fool people. It's very much what Satan did when he slithered into the garden. He didn't come up with a lie that was completely unrelated to something that Yahweh had said. He simply took what Yahweh had said, misquoted him, took it out of context, and twisted it to weave himself into the story. That is what fools people, and it's why God said, if you want to engage in a covenant relationship with me, if you want to become part of my family, the first requirement is that you're going to have to walk away from religion. And if you're unwilling to question your religion and walk away from it, it is impossible to engage in a relationship with God. And the reason for this is the corruptive nature of the religions. What we saw, if you go into the so-called Palestinian territories and you see the hopelessness and the poverty and the violence that exists there, is a direct result of the corruption of that religion. One of the things that I've wanted to do with this second hour of the program is to provide an introduction to a book that I wrote a long time ago called Yatiya. And the reason I wanted to do that is because the opening volumes of Yatiya present something that I thought would be very effective along the theme of this program, which is to shatter myths. The opening chapters speak of what actually is said regarding the creation accounts and how 15 billion years, us looking back in time, was exactly 6 days from the Creator witnessing creation, and how those times not only are the same, but how each day, each subsequent event in the creation account is precisely accurate as it relates to the history of the formation of the universe and then this planet and life thereon. And so I thought that would be a very interesting exercise to shatter the myths of the illusions that religion has fought with science, to show that God and science aren't at odds with each other and never have been. Then from there we go to there's chapters devoted to what actually occurred in the Garden of Eden. When you understand what happened in the Garden of Eden, and that embraces the covenant that Yah wants to establish with us. What shattered the relationship, what ultimately will bring the relationship together, what the relationship was like there, and how myth caused it to fail. You will have a much better understanding of our world and what our opportunities are in terms of reconciling that relationship and where the universe and we are headed. Then there is the most amazing story of all that follows one that is amazingly poorly understood, which is the story of the flood. And we will devote shows talking about what actually happened, what area was flooded, why it was flooded, and what the purpose of all of that was. Moving on then to the most amazing part of the Torah's teaching, which is the story of Yah forming a covenant relationship, the one and only covenant with Abraham, and sharing with Abraham the specific terms and conditions which Abraham had to embrace to engage in this relationship, five of which he delineates, and then there are five specific blessings of the covenant, and we will speak of each of them. This then will take us through the first volume of Yada Yah. And so what I've been trying to do in these last few shows is to get back into the text of this book so that through its prologue, I can actually help establish a foundation with you so that by way of that foundation, you'll be prepared to appreciate what God had to say on these really interesting, myth-shattering topics. Now, there, once we get through the first volume of Yada Yah, as we move forward in future shows, then the intent is to move to what is probably the most interesting aspect of the Torah and least understood, that God has a seven-step plan of salvation that is a derivative of the covenant that leads people from this world to his world, that the first step causes you to be immortal, the second step resolves your sinfulness and therefore redeems you. The third step causes you to be reborn as a spiritual child of the covenant. The fourth step on that path enriches you with his teaching and empowers you with his spirit. And so that I'm not the least bit coy here, let me share with you those specific steps. The first step is Passover. Passover resolves the consequence of sin, which is death. We become immortal when we observe Passover. But because our sin, our rebellion against God, our proclivity to embrace religion and politics and human institutions separates us from God and excludes us from entering his home, the next day, the day that Christians and Muslims and most people in the world know nothing about, is called unleavened bread. And unleavened bread, the purpose of which is to remove our rebellion against God from us so that we can enter his home. The third day of the three most important days in human history is when Yahusha fulfilled and enabled these promises, is Bukurim. Christians have renamed this Easter Sunday after the pagan mother of God, Queen of Heaven in Babylon. This day, Bukurim, is all about soul and spirit being brought together so that God can adopt us and cause us to be children of the covenant. It is about new birth and adoption. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We had one of those technical gremlins at the end of the last segment where the music that would tell us it's time to go to break unfortunately did not play, so I apologize for speaking right over one of our commercial sponsors. What I was sharing with you is that there is a seven-step path that Yah has provided for us to go from our polluted and corrupt world to his perfect home and be part of his covenant family. I shared with you that that the first four of these invitations to meet with God, they're called Moed Mikre. A Mikre is an invitation to be called out and to meet with God. Took place and were fulfilled, the first four of them, in 33 CE, which happened to be 4000 Yah, where Passover resolved the consequence of sin, which is death. We become immortal. Where unleavened bread, matzah, resolved the penalty of sin, which is separation from God, where all of the corrupt nature associated with our souls is removed. that takes us to Bukkotem. Now we're prepared to be born anew into Yah's covenant family. And Bukkotem, which means firstborn child, called first fruits by many, celebrates what occurred on this day. What Christians unfortunately call Easter Sunday is a myth that has pagan Babylonian heritage. But beyond that, the reality is that there was no bodily resurrection. A body would be a tremendous liability in eternity. And I say that because the Passover instructions are extraordinarily clear. The Passover lamb, the remaining body of the Passover lamb that is not consumed as food, that is not nourished, providing nourishment, is consumed that evening. So Yahusha's body as the Passover lamb would have ceased to exist the evening of Passover. And his soul is what fulfilled matzah, going to the place of separation, Sheol, paying the penalty for us on that day. And then on Bukkotem, his soul was reunited with his spirit, and in that reuniting of soul and spirit, what you had was a new creation. There's a reason why the women at the now empty tomb did not recognize him. There's a reason why the men on the road to Emmaus did not recognize him. There's a reason why the disciples in the upper room did not recognize him. He did not look anything like he previously did. And that is the transformational nature of Bukkotem, of being reborn spiritually into God's family. Seven Sabbaths later, 7 weeks later, we are collectively as those who are called out, we are enriched with Yah's Torah teaching. We are enlightened and empowered, so that not only can we be effective witnesses, but also so that we can grow as God's children. And so during the program yesterday, when Alex, who was, I believe, a Messianic Jew, called in and had many of his beliefs challenged, and the nice thing about Alex is when very unique amongst religious people, when something was said that proved that things that he had previously believed were false, he actually embraced them all the way through, saying, all right, I get it. Paul was a false prophet, and these things prove that Paul was a false prophet. And then he ended his with his last question, which we didn't unfortunately have time to cover, which is, well, what happened on seven Sabbaths? What happened when the Ruach Kodesh, the spirit of Yahweh, the set-apart spirit of Yahweh, enriched and empowered those on this day? Well, that's what happened. They were enriched with an understanding of the Torah. They were enlightened and empowered so that they could be effective witnesses and spokespeople on behalf of Yah's Torah teaching and on behalf of Yahusha's fulfillment of it, and so that they could grow as spiritual children of God. This then takes us to the fifth of seven invitations to meet with God, called trumpets. It is teruah. It means to not only shout for joy, but also to issue a warning to all who would listen that there is a singular path to God, and it goes through these seven steps. The sixth of the seven is the day of reconciliations, Yom Kippurim. This is the day that Yahusha will return to earth. If you want to know the day, that is the day. It is on Yom Kippurim, where his relationship, covenant relationship with Yehudim and Yisrael, will be reconciled so that we can enter the presence of Yahweh. And the seventh step is the destination. Everything in Scripture is about 6 + 1 equals the desired result. In this particular case, the desired result is to camp out with Yahweh, which is what Sukkah represents. This is Shattering This. Invite you to call during the next segment, 877-300-7645. To Shattering Myths, where we expose the misconceptions associated with religion and politics, military and economic schemes, and seek to engage God on his terms. as a surprise to many, the means to meet with God and to be saved by him are presented in his Torah and nowhere else. So that is why the second volume of Yadiyah, which we will consider in time, after considering the terms and conditions of the covenant itself as created with Abraham, between Abraham and Yahweh, we will contemplate every conceivable nuance of Yahweh's seven invitations, these festival feasts, and what they represent in terms of how we can walk to God, become perfected by him, adopted by him, empowered and enriched by him, ultimately camping out with him for all eternity, which is the very meaning of Sukkah, of shelters, of the last of the seven steps. Turning then to the third volume of Yadiyah, which we will cover in time, is the book of our review of the book of Hosea. Hosha is the man's actual name. It means salvation. It is pivotal in the lives of God's chosen people. So when we examine it from beginning to end, we're going to learn the consequence of rejecting the Torah and its covenant. Yahweh says in the midst of that book that that his people, because they are ignorant of his teaching, because they are unaware, are destroying themselves. And that he goes on to say, because you have forgotten my Torah teaching, I will forget your children. And so there is a genuine consequence of us being ignorant. And that's the essence of this program, is I want to provide for you the opportunity to know. And once you know, then to create the perspective so that you might understand. And once you understand, you are empowered to use free will to respond appropriately. And that is the very course that we are going to chart through these prophetic books. Now, the means to reconcile our relationship is the focus of the Salvation Volume, Volume 4 of Yadiyah. Here, though, rather than examining the work and the words of the Masiyah, Yahusha, the actual title and name of the person mischaracterized as Jesus Christ, from the perspective of the Greek historical texts, as many are wont to do, we're instead going to come to understand what he did and what he said by reading Yahweh's prophetic, albeit also eyewitness accounts, of what occurred in Jerusalem in year 4000 Yah, which is 33 CE. What is interesting is because Yahweh can maneuver in time, because he is not stuck in the normal flow of time as we are, he has actually witnessed, he has participated in our future. And he reported back to us between the 700 and 1,000 years before these events took place in our ordinary flow of time, precisely what was going to happen on Passover, unleavened bread, first fruits, and seven Sabbaths in our year 33 CE, his year 4000 Yah. And what is really surprising here is that the detail and the vivid nature of the presentation of what occurred on these days is much more completely presented in the prophetic books written 700 to 1,000 years before the events took place than what we find in the eyewitness accounts. So as a result of doing this, you're going to be able to experience the method and means behind the most extraordinary offer ever made. It will be as if you were there, or better, because unlike the eyewitnesses, you will have a copy of Yahweh's plan, and thereby know exactly what happened and why it occurred that way. And as a result, you will discover that God did not die. In fact, God cannot die. So this notion that God died to save you is a myth. God can't die. God did not die. There was no cross. That's a pagan symbol. There was no resurrection, at least no bodily resurrection. So you'll know what did not occur, and then you will also know what actually did occur, and why that is far more wonderful and marvelous than the myth that is perpetrated by Christians. The actual story is vastly more magnificent. Now, that is not to say that we won't analyze the Greek text written by two eyewitnesses and a couple of historical hearsay portraits, but only that the Christian New Testament is not inspired. It is, at best, a poorly kept translation of what was said, and therefore it is not nearly as enlightening or insightful or trustworthy as are the prophetic portrayals of what would happen and why. For the most part, this Christian New Testament isn't even remotely accurate, which is why we will have to be remarkably careful when we turn to it. And yet by devoting the fifth volume of Yada Yah to the good news associated with Yahweh honoring his Torah promises, we will still find a wealth of reassuring affirmations. The very testimony Christians find confusing will for the first time make complete sense. For example, have you ever wondered why Yosha said that his upcoming sacrifice could be equated to Yonah's? Yonah means Yah's dove or spirit, but corrupted to Jonah's. That his upcoming sacrifice and his ordeal would transpire over the course of 3 full days and 3 full nights, when the eyewitnesses speak of the events which began on Friday afternoon and conclude before sunrise on Sunday, which is not 3 full days and 3 full nights. So Christians trying to resolve that said, well, maybe the crucifixion took place on Wednesday, not on Passover. And they end up contradicting the eyewitness accounts to come up with an explanation of how both could be true. But we're going to walk through precisely what happened on that boat on the stormy seas with Jonah, and then going to compare that directly to what actually occurred in Jerusalem in 33 CE to show that both are absolutely accurate. Another example. Have you ever wondered why Yosha asked, my God, why have you forsaken me? Which means that the spirit of Yahweh left the soul and body of Yosha while he was on the upright pole of the doorway to life, serving as the Passover lamb. Well, we're going to examine why the spirit of Yahweh had to leave him at that point, why his body died as the Passover lamb, and why his soul, his consciousness, continued in its journey into Sheol, the place of separation, the one place that Yahweh himself cannot go. When you understand what actually happened as opposed to the Babylonian and the corrupted myths associated with what happened, you're going to find a much more compelling explanation. More troubling still, since Christianity is predicated and predicated upon its New Testament and how that replaced the Old Testament, why then, in his most famous speech, did Yosha say that the Torah, the heart and soul of what is now called the Old Testament, why did he say that it would never be annulled, that nothing in it would be changed? Well, these are questions with which we will grapple, and that God himself will answer. But that is not to say that Christians will find God's answers acceptable. They won't. They will reject most of God's answers outright, preferring instead Paul's testimony. And that is why the sixth volume of Yada Yah is called Goddamn Religion. In it, we will consider the adversarial role of Babylon, and more specifically of Babel. From the beginning of recorded history to the final prophetic comment issued by God, where he begs us to walk out of and away from Babylon. The covenant begins with God asking us to walk away from Babel, and his final statement to us ends, concludes, with him still begging us to walk away from Babylon. As a shock to the souls of Christians, especially Roman Catholics, they represent Babylon in today's world. Of the church, Yahusha says in his prophetic revelation letters that they are the seat of Satan, that they are married to Satan, and that they are dead as a result. God will even tell us that he does not hear the prayers of those who do not observe his Torah. This will be a shock for many of you. Should you be able to endure this level of detail? Should you be willing to invest the time required to examine all of the connections and associations God has made, contemplating the symbols and metaphors which permeate his every thought? You will come to Yada, which means to know Yahweh. You won't have to have faith. You won't have to believe. You will come to know him as he actually is. And if you have an open mind, if you're willing to be resolutely rational, you will also come to understand what he is offering us. You will be prepared to capitalize on Yahweh's covenant relationship, including the plan of salvation, which makes it possible. This progression of things, of coming to know Yahweh first, capitalizing upon his covenant relationship second, and then relying upon his plan of salvation third, is one of the many things Christians get wrong. They never come to know God as he revealed himself in his Torah teaching or in his prophets and Psalms. Their religion focuses instead on a diminished subset of God and on what one has to believe to be saved. God isn't going to save anyone that doesn't first come to know him. And there is no salvation apart from covenant. Christians have the order upside down and reversed. Long after God introduced himself to us in the first book of the Torah, Bereshith, which means in the beginning, he explains the nature of his Bereth family-oriented covenant relationships. The very relationship that he wants to develop with us. His only purpose in creating the universe and of authoring life. And as part of those Torah instructions, Yahweh describes what is required of us to participate in this relationship. And that is why most of what we speak about will be focused on those five terms and conditions. This is Shattering Myths. 877-300-7645. If you'd like to ask a question, be part of the conversation, or challenge anything you hear. Shattering Myths, the last segment of our show today. Well, as we continue with this study and we turn the pages of the Torah, we're going to find Yahweh not only explaining his name and telling us how to pronounce his name, he will reveal precisely how he would like us to view him and how he wants us to live our lives, scribing his perspective in stone. Therefore, we will carefully examine the words Yahweh personally etched on these two tablets. And unless you are already a serious student of the Torah, I dare say you'll be shocked by how different God's revelations are from man's most popular renditions of what's called the Ten Commandments. One of the things that you will learn is there isn't one commandment among the ten. There's only one of the ten statements even that is written in the imperative mood, and it's the one where volition reigns supreme. There are no commandments. There are statements, and there are instructions. One of the things that I found most intriguing, and fairly recently, was that when we dive into the unique nature of Hebrew grammar, what we find is that virtually all of the three statements and the seven instructions that comprise the ten statements overall, of which are three are statements, and seven are specific instructions, that most all of them are written in what's called the imperfect conjugation. And this means that God isn't suggesting that we never do anything on this list, but he's saying instead, don't make a habit of it. Don't do these things on an ongoing basis. It's like a dad saying, yeah, I know you're going to trip. You're going to fall off the bike, for example, when you are learning to ride. It's just that I don't want you to fall off the bike every time you ride. And so we're going to find that in these seven instructions, that they are written in the imperfect conjugation for imperfect children, recognizing that our Heavenly Father is trying to guide our attitude and approach to life, not expecting perfection of us. I want you to be more fully aware of the uncommon and surprising nature of Hebrew grammar. Now, I am not a grammatarian, and I must tell you that even though when I say grammar, some of you might say, oh boy, that's the last thing that I want to devote time to, a radio program learning about grammar, particularly grammar in a foreign language. But I'm here to tell you that when you come to appreciate the unique nature of Hebrew grammar, your eyes are going to be opened. It is a powerful tool to help you understand not only who God is, but how we can relate to Him. And some of the examples of this are that in Hebrew grammar, there is no past, present, or future tense. All verbs are simply true in time. They endure all time. So this notion of you speak about something that was or speak of something that is so inconsistent with God's nature. Truth simply is. So in Hebrew, there is no past, present, or future tense. Virtually every Hebrew verb has what's called a relational stem that tells you about the relationship between the object and the subject of that verb. And since the object or the subject of most of Yah's teaching is Him and us, it tells you precisely how His word will influence our relationship. And lastly, in Hebrew, there is this concept of moods. Virtually everything that is described in the action or verbs of Hebrew are subject to volition. The moods are volitional, which means that rather than being orders or laws that we are to obey, they are instead instructions for us to choose, to accept, to embrace, to act upon, but only under the auspices of free will. There is so much that we can learn that is never communicated in your English translation. And we're going to focus on these things. We're going to observe them so that you know precisely what you need to know and understand to engage in a relationship with God. So there is nothing more important than you coming to know why God chose to reveal Himself to us in Hebrew. And you're going to develop an appreciation for the uniquenesses and nuances of this language. Through the Torah itself, God's going to direct your attention to the five terms and conditions which comprise His covenant. These terms and conditions are that we walk away from religion and that we come to trust and rely exclusively on Him. That we walk to Him and become perfect, which He Himself enables. That we observe, which is to carefully consider the instructions associated with His covenant. And that we raise our families, our sons and our children, so that they remember this covenant. May God bless. Look forward to being with you tomorrow.
I've seen the longevity products work for many others, and so I bought a bunch of them, started using them, had a little bit of results, but I wasn't following the regimen every day. But Aaron Dyke